So I am interviewing John Devins, and this is my backup recorder. So
good to have two.
It's good to have two. And this one is going to give, it's only good for a half hour. Okay, so tell me about what it was like to be in your position when the oil spill happened.
Well, in 1989, I was mayor of Valdez. I'd been mayor for nearly 5 years by then. Prior to the actual event happening, we recognized that the promises we had about being able to respond in the event of an oil spill were exaggerated. The industry, primarily Alyeska, didn't have all of the equipment that we expected them to have. They had a contingency plan, and the contingency plan indicated that within 72 hours they would be able to respond and pick up so much oil. But in fact, we knew that they had one barge, and it had a hole in the bottom, and it was up on the beach. They didn't have enough absorbent materials. They didn't have enough skimmers. They didn't have enough booming material. So Bill Walker, who was city attorney at the time, and I concocted an idea of what was called Zone 3. Valdez has three zones, taxing zones. And by law...
Taxing zone?
Zones that we can apply property tax.
Taxing.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. We still have three. One is downtown, one is out the road, an alpine area, alpine wood area. And the other just happens to be across the bay where the terminal is. Now, it wasn't necessarily set up that way, but it just happened to be that way. And we used to have differential taxes for the zones depending on the amount of service that was provided. Very little service out the road, so their taxes were lower, more services in town. Well, at the time, just prior to the spill, all tax zones were the same, as I recall, about 14 mills. The state and feds allow us to tax whatever oil property, and there's only three municipalities that get to tax the oil property. The North Slope Borough, the North Star Borough, and Valdez. The rest of it, where the pipeline runs, is called the balance of the state, and the state gets to tax that. And that's taxed at 20 mills, I believe. It was either 20 or 21 mills, but I think it was 20 mills. So the difference between 14 mills and 20 mills, of course, is 6 mills. So we went ahead and raised the taxes on Tax Zone 3 and took that extra 6 mills and banked it with the idea that we were going to build a terminal, a response terminal. We were going to buy skimmers, we were going to buy absorbent materials, going to have a laydown area, because we recognized the potential of an oil spill. So at the time of the spill, we had about $26 million in the bank to do this. We hadn't started doing it because the state challenged us and said, no, you can't do that. That money's ours, meaning the state's. Alyeska didn't challenge us on it because they were going to pay 20 mills anyway. Mm-hmm. So along with that, as mayor, I formed what was called the Mayor's Ad Hoc Committee on what would happen in the event of a large oil spill. And I appointed people from all walks of life in Valdez. It was a fairly large committee. It was headed by Stan Stevens. And the night of the spill, we were having our meeting. Stan was chairing it. I was there. And we were talking about what would happen if there was a large spill. As it turned out, we also had Ricky Ott from Cordova tied in as to make comments. And Ricky was on the telephone and said, gentlemen, it's not a matter of if you have an oil spill, it's a matter of when you have an oil spill. And just a few hours later, we had our country's largest oil spill. Now comes my part, other than being at the committee meeting, but About 6 a.m., Dave Hammack, who is head of public radio here in Valdez and also is known for Alaska Running, Dave was a good announcer, and he called me, and we were good friends. And David called me about 6 a.m. and said, "John, you better get up and put your mayoral hat on. You got an oil spill." I said, "David, what in the world? You're calling me at 6 a.m. to tell me we have an oil spill? We've had other oil spills. Why are you bothering me now?" He said, "John, you've never had an oil spill like this. This is a real oil spill." So I got up, and within an hour, I had the fellow. I was president of the college. Being mayor was very much a part-time job. My full-time job was being president of the college. So I got my media person from the college, got him down with cameras and put him on Stan Stevens' boat. Stan was going to be the first one out on the spill. Stan took him out while I got a hold of another fellow that worked for me at the college who had been a reporter for most of his life, and his name was Michael Pelican. And Michael and I started to look around to see if we could get a flight out to see what was going on. We've finally got a hold of Chuck Page, who's a local commercial pilot here, and he said he could take us out at 11. By then, Bob Keller, who was on the city council, got a hold of me, and so it was Michael, Bob, and I, and we got on the phone, and we started making calls to the industry. Now, understand, at this point, of course, we were a little naive because I was calling Exxon. I was calling people like Frank Iorossi and people like that, not getting hold of anybody because they were all en route trying to come to Valdez. But I was calling saying, "Hey, you know, city's here to help. You've had an accident. How can we be of service? What do you need? We'll help you financially if you need it," because I knew we were sitting on $26 million. I thought, well, if they need some skimmers. I didn't realize that Exxon was richer than God, and there wasn't anything Valdez had that they really needed. But at any rate, I make that point because the first few days, we were pretty friendly and trying to be pretty helpful. I remember that day, that whole day was just a madhouse of trying to get things done, making sure that we called people. I called the mayor of Cordova, Erling Johansson, and told him that there had been a spill. But Georgia Buck, who was the mayor of Whittier, I didn't think to call Georgia. And Georgia didn't know for a day. It was the next day that she found out that the spill had happened. But I got a hold of Erling. I called Stephen McAlpine, was the lieutenant governor at the time, and Stephen and I had served on the Valdez City Council together. We were good friends, used to travel together. So I called Stephen, let him know what I knew. Steve Cooper, the governor, came in that day, and I remember meeting him out at the airport and going into a conference with Steve and some of the DEC people. And there was a lot of argument with the industry because the industry was talking about using dispersants, and we had some environmental types that were very much opposed, and of course all of the fisheries were opposed to using dispersants. So I remember that as being a pretty big deal. And then 11 o'clock, Chuck LePage took Bob Keller, Michael Pelican, and myself out, and we flew over it. And we saw one lone boat down there pulling something behind it, and it didn't look like they were doing anything. And you had this big lake of oil that was off to the west side of the Exxon Valdez. And we watched that for a while, and finally I said, "What in the world is that little boat doing down there?" And Michael, who was a reporter, said, "Well, John, those are for photo opportunities." It wasn't doing anything, but press was flying out and flying over, and they had to have a picture of something, so they had a picture of this boat just running back and forth on the edge of the oil spill. So the rest of that day was watching people. The first wave of folks that came into the town really were the reporters. The reporters arrived very quickly. And then the agency people got coming into town, and the industry people got coming into town. By the end of that first day, I don't think there were any rooms left in town. There were no rental automobiles available. The agency people had started to fight over office space. Everybody was here to help us get out of the way kind of attitude that we were running into.
When you say agency people, who does that entail?
Well, it's all of the federal and state agencies that thought that they had some dog in this fight.
I see.
It was DEC, I want to say Homeland Security, but we didn't have that then. But it was, I'm trying to think of there's a federal agency that was involved with security at the time. I can't remember all of them.
I can dig that out. That's
Coast Guard, It was all of the regulatory agencies that they all wanted office space, and they all thought that they were most important. And during that week, that first week, I know we ran into a lot of problems because we had governmental agencies coming in here and constructing things that weren't in city code, so we had to worry about that. We had the ongoing worry that, well, we went from a town of a little less than 4,000 people to over 12,000 people, and a lot of the people were living in visqueen tents, or if you found a place, if you happened to be lucky enough to have a motorhome or a camper, and you found a place to park it, you sure weren't going to leave there to empty your tanks.
Yeah.
You dug a little hole and hoped nobody noticed it. Yeah. You were doing that. And so we were worrying a lot. We had a lot of concern about public health.
Yes.
Well, that the evening of the spill, I had called a special city council meeting because we had to decide. We were sitting on, like I say, about $26 million. And that evening, the council did appropriate to go ahead and spend $1 million of that to do things like we had to have a place to put absorbent materials. We didn't know much, but we knew that they were going to have to put some sort of absorbent materials down, and they had to have a place to put it because you just can't lay it on the ground, or it absorbs into the ground then. So we did that, and I remember a local fisherman who's a pretty hard-boiled guy. He had been out, and he had noted what was going on out there, and he came in and spoke to us that evening. And I remember him breaking down and crying in front of the city council, which was not something anybody would ever expect.
Right.
And even today, you can get people talking about it, and their voice will start to quaver a bit. And it was a very, very emotional experience for everyone. I mean, to have fishermen break down and cry because they saw oiled sea otters when a week before they'd have been glad to shoot the sea otters, but they really, really felt that the Prince William Sound had been insulted pretty seriously. Well, the next 2 days, well, the first 3 days pretty much were the same. Industry didn't have equipment. You had fishermen that were going out cutting down trees and making log booms. And you had the city of Valdez trying to insert itself into the information and decision-making loop. And we couldn't get in. It was real hard to get Exxon, and then later Vico, because Vico became the responder for Exxon. The way it works was the first few days, it's Alyeska's responsibility, and it still is today, to respond until the shipper can get up and running, and then they take it over from Alyeska, and then they do it. And in this case, Exxon then hired Vico to do most of the contractual things. But here we had end of March, when the weather in Prince William Sound can be harsh, and we had 3 days that it was calm. It was like a lake out there. There was hardly a ripple in the water, and they didn't have pumps. And if they had pumps, they didn't have any place to really put the oil, because you've got to have barges to pump the oil into. They didn't. And it began to become kind of a slow boil. People were really getting angry. We went from, how can we help, to what in the hell are you people doing? Where are the skimmers? Where's the boom? Where's the absorbent materials? Where are the barges to store the oil in? And of course, the Exxon had another serious problem, because they had the Exxon Valdez up on rocks, and they had to get it lightered and get the oil off. Now, I will give them good marks on that. They did a great job of getting another Exxon ship in and getting it lightered. Now, at the time, you also had, it was different in 89, because we were, as I said earlier, we were really naive. We didn't know about, we just didn't know how to have a good oil spill. You know, we had people out there. I remember I was talking to Stan Stevens earlier today, and I was saying, Stan, if I remember this correctly, I remember you telling how you turned on the pumps for your seawater, you know, for your toilets in his boat. They were drawing from about 3.5 or 4 feet down. And he turned them on to use the toilet in the boat, and it was pumping pure oil. It was that deep. I mean, the oil was 3-4 feet deep at that time. You had all of the fumes and vapors giving off, and we had people complaining about, I don't know what's wrong, but I've got nasal congestion. I can't breathe. My eyes are running. I've got these skin rashes. And yeah. And I remember, I don't know if it was Exxon or Vico, was telling them, oh, there's a virus going around. Well, no, we know today. You know, you don't even go near things like that unless you wear respirators. But we didn't know that then. We did. You know, I remember the first team that came in. Now, I'm jumping kind of 2 weeks ahead. But about 2 weeks into the spill, they finally changed out some of the workers. They'd been out there for a couple of weeks. And they came in, and they came into the ferry dock. And I was down there, as a good mayor should, and I was watching them come off. And most of them were in a big hurry to get to the bar, and they really want to stop and talk to the mayor. But some of them wouldn't. I'd say, hey, you know, are they providing you with personal protective equipment? Are you using anything out there to protect yourself? And they said, oh, no. I said, we've got some of the foremen out there tell us not to be concerned. It's just oil. It's not anything that's going to hurt you. And if you're a wimp, yeah, we can give you something, but you don't need it. Well, today we know, yeah, you do. Other things that the other screw-ups back then was, and it was an honest error, but we didn't know any better. I shouldn't say we. Exxon or Vico didn't know any better. They used steam and hot water on those beaches because once the oil got up on the beach, somehow you had to get it off from the beach back in the water where you could use a skimmer or absorbent materials. Well, they applied it with steam and hot water, which now today we know drove a lot of that oil down into the beach. And today you can go out there and dig a hole and it looks like fresh oil. You can turn over a rock and it still looks like fresh oil. Where in the South, after 18 to 20 years, the bacteria would take care of that oil. But here, we don't have very much nitrogen in our soil, and it requires nitrogen and it requires oxygen. And of course, if you drive it very far down into the ground, you don't have a lot of oxygen down there. And we have very, very little nitrogen. So there isn't biodegradation of this oil. It just stays there for a long, long time. So I'm getting ahead of my story. So about day three, there were a lot of us that had really gotten angry. I remember, I think it was like on the third day, it could have been the fourth day, probably was the fourth day, I was invited to be on a press conference. And it was, as I recall, it was Exxon, Coast Guard, DEC, myself, and there was one other, and I can't remember who the one other was. And it was kind of a scripted press conference. And these press conferences were interesting because they were it was like a circus often. I mean, one time we had some of the environmental groups had leaked information to us that there was a young woman that was going to come in and she had dead oiled birds in her backpack and she was going to throw them at Frank Iorossi as he stood on the stage. Well, they leaked it to us, so we had the city's finest out in the hall waiting for this young lady to come in. And, of course, we had a lot. You know, you had fishermen, you had environmentalists, you had industry people, you had all of these folks. Well, and every press conference, it was just virtual standing crowd. I mean, it was everybody wanted to go to those early press conferences. In comes a young woman that was dressed for the part. I mean, long gingham dress, you know, it really looked like kind of a 60s, 70s hippie type of young lady. She came in, she has a backpack on, two of our city's finest step up to her and say, "Young lady, we have to look in your backpack," and she raises hell and won't let them look, and of course they wrestle it off, and there was no bird in it. It was just, she wanted the press attention. Of course the photographers are there taking pictures, and but it was that sort of thing. Well, on this particular press conference where we had the four or five agencies, if you can think of the city as an agency, we were supposed to get up there, and by then, I think everybody realized that we were all somewhat culpable in this event. Complacency had ruled. Now, I think the city was less at fault because we were beginning to realize that things weren't right. And you know, you talk about instincts and so forth. Well, this was more than instinct. It was, you could look at it and you could see where Elias at one time had a crack team that was supposed to respond to spills. They had reassigned them, and you didn't have people that were on the oil spill response team. That was gone. We knew that the equipment, they didn't have enough equipment. So we knew all of that. But at any rate, I think the Coast Guard realized that, yeah, they should have been looking at those contingency plans. The state certainly should have been looking at it. The industry should certainly have been able to live up to what they had written. I've often referred to the contingency plan we had in 1989 as ranking as one of the exceptional works of fiction, because it was, nothing in it was true. It was well written, it just... the practice part of it never occurred. So we were kind of scripted, and it became apparent to me that Coast Guard didn't want to point a finger at the state, because the state could point a finger back, and of course they could both point fingers at the industry. And so everybody was supposed to get up there, and as I recall that meeting, we were supposed to talk about how good everything was going. And when you're up on the stage of these press conferences, you have the first row, there were probably 8 or 10 national TV groups. Plus, there was one that nobody knew until later that summer. Exxon had a film crew posing as a news crew, so that they were videotaping everything, because they figured they were going to get lots of lawsuits, which they did. And they were, I'm assuming that's why they wanted to keep all this footage. But you had them, but you couldn't look out there and say, oh, well, that's from ABC and that's from CBS. I mean, they were all guys that were, and some gals that were dressed in kind of outdoor garb, because they were going out on the islands and doing video out there. And they had all, the whole front row were these cameras. And then behind them was a mixture of, well, could be some environmental, some lots of fisheries people, some industry people. Well,
and smattering of the town.
And a smattering of the town, yeah, because the room was always full. We always had lots and lots of people. And I remember I think I was the third or the fourth speaker. I don't remember, but I know the first two or three speakers, they were saying, "Oh yes, it's going well. We're doing great." And I'm thinking, "Oh, no, they're not. We don't have the equipment. We don't have what we need to respond to the spill." And so I had my note, and I remember tearing it up, and getting up, and blowing the roof off. I said, "This is BS." I said, "They're not responding. They don't have equipment. They haven't lived up to what they promised us." And when I got done, I get the standing ovation. And truly, my life changed at that point. From then on, I was the guy that was constantly calling Exxon and then later Vico to task on what they weren't doing. I was never invited to appear at another one of their press conferences.
Well, no. Now, when you say you were Exxon and Vico, what about Alyeska?
I tried to be gentle with Alyeska. I had to live here.
Right.
And it was, when I was mayor, 94% to 96% of our tax base came from taxing the oil industry, which essentially was Alyeska. Mm-hmm. Now, Alyeska got very angry at me. In fact, I keep I keep notes all the time. My life is notes. I read this getting ready for, this was my journal of the time, because I knew when the spill happened, I called Bill Walker, our attorney, our city attorney, and said, Bill, we got to know, what are we supposed to be doing? And Bill tried to call around, and the only thing, you couldn't find cities that really had much information. Nobody really knew, other than always the advice came back, keep good records, because you're probably going to want to sue them. As it turned out, Valdez never did sue. But I kept really good records. And as I've gone back over today reading those records, I had forgotten how mad some of this community was at me. Just, oh, I mean, they had signs up over at Alyeska, Benedict Arnold Devins. And I had city council people coming to me saying, John, you got to back off. We don't like you roughing up the industry this much. I didn't back off, but there was always, you know, they were always threatening to hold a special city council meeting to get me in line. They never quite did that, but there was always that threat that they would. The town was fairly divided. I don't know if it was 50-50, 40-60, but it was divided from a strong element of the community that were very defensive and pro-oil industry. And believe me, this town benefited greatly from the oil industry. I mean, schools and hospitals and my college and everything benefited from having the oil industry here. So you had people that were extremely defensive on that standpoint. And then you had the other side of the community that were totally incensed by the fact that not so much that they spilled the oil. Accidents happen. Everybody realizes you can have an accident. But don't promise that you're going to be able to respond to it and then not be able to do it. And I think that's what angered people the most. And then there was a lot of sadness. Everybody was busy. My college emptied out. I didn't have a student left. They all went out to the islands. They were earning $17 an hour. Somebody said it was $16.95, but it was something like that. And then they got time and a half for overtime, and there was a lot of overtime. And so the people that were left here in town, we didn't have, but if you worked for, say, the local hotel, and you were earning minimum wage, you quit those jobs and you went out and lived out in the Sound, and you couldn't spend any money. There's no place to spend money out there. So what you ended up having were a town that had, the prices went up. I mean, everything was more expensive because the restaurants had to pay their people more money. Therefore, they had to pass that on. And those of us who weren't getting any money for working on the spill, we were kind of stuck paying the extra costs. Exxon, or as it turned out, Vico, would end up hiring almost anybody that wanted a job. And the ones they wouldn't hire were people that had known criminal records, were known drinkers, alcoholics, drug users, people like that. And they were what was left in our town for the most part. And so crime went up. We had a lot more emotional kinds of problems, more family abuse kinds of situations, more alcoholism, more drug use. I remember September, the end of September, when everything was over, we had a whole bunch of cars stolen in Valdez. Now, automobile theft is not a real issue in Valdez when the first crossroads it goes anyplace is Glen Allen. That's 115 miles up the road. You're not going to get away with stealing automobiles in Valdez, but we did. We had a lot of them stolen. We would go. Exxon was pretty good about paying for extra costs. And I think that's why probably Valdez. Partly because I think Valdez didn't sue Exxon, partly because they were very good about settling costs, but also because Valdez is pretty much an oil town. I mean, we have three industries here. We have the oil industry, we have tourism, and a small fisheries. And so Valdez didn't sue, but I remember We could go to Exxon, and there was a process for doing this, and you'd go and say, hey, you know, there's just too much junk piling up in town. We need more refuse workers. And invariably, they'd say, okay, yeah, how much? And they would pay for that. But when we would go and say, you know, we need more mental health workers. We've got people that are just in dire straits. For some reason, they never would do that. They didn't like to pay for mental health work. And I have to believe it was probably due to litigation. I can't think of any other reason, because they were very generous on, you need more cops? Sure, you can have more cops. So have what you want. Another thing that was always disturbing during that period of time, Frank Iarossi, I felt Frank was a pretty good guy. I mean, he worked for a company that wasn't very popular in Alaska at that time. Frank probably wore a three-piece suit at home in Texas, but in Valdez, he looked like Mr. Rogers. He wore a cardigan sweater, and he was very nice and very gentle, and he had fishermen calling him everything in the book, and Frank never lost it. I think he probably caused Exxon some extra problems because he was a nice guy, and I think he was honest. I think he meant what he said. But I remember him standing up at one of the press conferences, one of the early ones, and raising his hand and saying, Exxon will stand behind all of the losses. We will take care of you. We're not going to let anybody lose money on this. You just submit your invoices and your receipts, and Exxon will take care of it. Well, that was okay for Frank, but then when his bean counters came in, they weren't reading from the same script that Frank Iarossi was reading from. They were not nearly as generous. Well, that left a lot of people in all of these communities thinking that they should have gotten more than they did get. And of course, you know, today we're still fighting over the originally a little over $5 billion in punitive damages, and now I guess the courts have cut it down to about $2.5 billion, but it's been too long, and there's a lot of resentment about that. But initially, I think if you were a fisherman and you could show your 88 receipts for what you sold your fish for, and then you showed an 89, well, essentially they had no, because it was a zero tolerance at that time, so they just never did get to sell fish. And theoretically, at least, Exxon paid that difference. But that was only good for 1 year. How about 90 and 91? Because the fish that died in the oil spill, if they were pink salmon, they're coming back in 2 years. And I guess if they were silvers, it was three, right? I don't know what the life cycle of salmon is. But there were years where it was a problem. And then if you were in the tourist industry, and I don't think Exxon did anything for the people that were in the tourist industry, but tourism ended that year. I mean, probably the people that owned hotels and restaurants, they probably made their money because they had other people here. But then the next year, they didn't. And it took a couple of years before tourism built back up. So the economy was hurt. That summer, I had been working as mayor. I had been working for several years trying to get what we called reverse investments. And that was Asian business people coming into Valdez and investing in this community. Reverse, I guess, means because we don't have Americans going there and investing. But I had a lot of Japanese investors that came to Valdez, and we had no place to put them. We took them out to Growler Island, which Stan Stevens had a camp on Growler Island for his tour industry. And that's where we had to put them because there were no hotels, there were no homes, there was nothing available. And they had several projects that they were ready to finance and go with. They wanted a mineral water project. They wanted bottled water. This was early. Now everybody's bottling water. They wanted to buy glacier ice. And it just was the neatest idea because the Columbia Glacier, when it calves, if you had your off months for your fishing boats, you could go out there and capture glacier ice.
Right.
And bring it in, and every other day they wanted us to ship a 40-foot container of glacier ice to Japan. That one sounded pretty good. And then we've got the grain terminal, which we've never found a use for. They wanted to buy the grain terminal or lease it and put in a microbrewery there. And again, it's the Japanese really, you know, they have this thing about Prince William Sound, the pristine beauty, the cleanliness, everything. Well, after you spill 11 million gallons of crude oil, it loses some of that pristine beauty, and we lost all of that. There are other people in the state, I remember even Ketchikan, lost tourism because the tourists didn't realize just how far away Ketchikan was. Ketchikan never saw a drop of oil, but they lost tourism. And, Exxon didn't cover those. There were a lot of things that they didn't cover. I remember, I was president of the college, and I lived in a house right next to the college. And I had, I bought a jacuzzi tub, a pretty big jacuzzi tub, and it was sitting on my porch because I was going to install it in the house. And one day I came home and it was missing. And by then I'd turned the college over to Exxon for animal rehab. They had sea otters in my gymnasium, they had birds in classrooms, and we were doing animal rehab there at the college. And I went up, and lo and behold, there's my jacuzzi tub. And they're doing bird washing and such in my jacuzzi tub. And I got a little upset about that and told them to get that thing cleaned up and get it back on my porch. But it was that sort of thing that, and I think the town suffered from the stress of having so many people descending on us. And, you know, we're all heroes in our own comic strip. And they were all heroes in their comic strips, and they didn't realize that there were lots of other things going on here. And everybody was just outraged if they couldn't get at the office they wanted. Or I remember it was the first couple, 3 days after the spill, being out at the airport and listening to people. People would be out there, and somebody would get off the airplane, and often it was the press. Because they had a little more money to spend. Well, the industry had lots of money to spend. But they'd get off and they'd see somebody and say, they'd go over to the automobile rental area and want to rent an automobile and find out, no, we're out of automobiles. And so they'd see somebody and say, do you have a car? Well, yeah. Do you want to rent it? No, I can't rent you my car. I'll give you $100 a day. Well, I don't know. I'll give you $125 a day. Here are the keys. And do you need a place to sleep? Well, yeah. Well, you know, I think I can put the kids out in the camper and you can have the kids' room. How about another $100 a day for the kids' room? It was that sort of thing. It was very disturbing. I mean, everybody was just...
The sheer volume of people on the street, I would think, would be...
Oh, it was. And like I say, well, I was telling you about the visqueen tents. That people were living in visqueen tents or maybe their campers. And some people didn't even have that. So... Nobody ever locked their doors in Valdez. Most people didn't even take the keys out of their car. I mean, it was that kind of a place. And I got to where I had to lock my car every night, or you'd get up in the morning, go out, and there'd be two or three people sleeping in your car because they'd want to get out of the weather. People talk about people getting under their porch and sleeping there. It was the press of people. Mm-hmm. Was horrible in Valdez. I mean, it just was just too much.
Now, tell me the type of person who would be inclined to come to Valdez at that point.
Well, Channel 13 had... I used to think it was Channel 2. My memory always told me it was John Tracy, but it turned out it wasn't John Tracy. It was the Channel 13 newsman. He had a big thing at the Civic Center. And it was supposed to be a panel of us. I was in D.C., and I was testifying before Congress and beginning fighting with Don Young when he called me and said he had to have me back here for this meeting. So it was tough. I did get back, and I got there in time for the meeting. I looked out, and the auditorium, it's the slope floor auditorium at the Civic Center, seats 550 people. And every one of those people swore that they were a resident of Valdez, and I only knew a handful of them. It was people all over. There was work in Valdez, and they were there, and there was preference shown to hire locals. Mm-hmm. So they all said, oh yeah, I live in Valdez. Well, no, a lot of them didn't live in Valdez. A lot of them were well-meaning. We had a lot of people that came to Valdez and wanted to volunteer. And I can understand why Exxon and Vico didn't want the volunteers. I mean, there's a liability issue there if you've got volunteers. It's better that you pay them and they're covered by workers' compensation and so forth. But we had a lot of people, and they did use some volunteers early on in terms of the Bird Rehab Center. And they may have used volunteers longer in Bird Rehab, but I don't think they used any volunteers on the cleanup. Mm. You had, what would it have been, a week or two after the spill. That was, well, in fact, it just predates this this Channel 13 interview, or well, it was news conference, but it was a huge panel news conference. I had been in D.C., and I was testifying, and I had been invited to speak at a press conference breakfast at the National Press Club. And, in fact, the night before, they had the Cherry Blossom Festival, which is a big deal for Alaskans that are in the D.C. area. And I went to it, and Don Young was there, and Don and I had words, and he told me to be careful or I was going to get in trouble. And he says, the president is going to make an announcement tomorrow, and it's going to fix everything. So the next day, I think that was when I was having breakfast at the press club, and the announcement was made that George Bush was going to send 5,000 military people in to clean up this oil spill. And, I mean, it was ludicrous. They wouldn't have known where to begin. And so I remember being asked, what did I think of that? And I said, well, it seems to me that if any of our local people want to get compensated for what's going on here, they better join the military. And I said, I don't think it's feasible. I don't think it's a good idea at all. And later it was called off, and I don't know if it was because of me or not. I remember in those days, a lot of my time was spent trying to get a national declaration of disaster. Ted Stevens opposed it, and I'm inclined to believe that Ted was right, and I was wrong, but I spent a lot of time doing that, and getting the Small Business Association to come in and make low-interest loans, because we had people that weren't going to survive. You know, if you're a fisherman, and you've got a $1 million boat, and you're making payments on it, and you don't have any fishing that summer, and you have to wait until the end of the summer and until you get your receipts into Exxon and hope you get your money, in the meantime, you could lose your boat. And so we got the Small Business Association when I was back in D.C. We worked on that to get them to come to Valdez and meet with these folks and make very low-interest loans to see them through until they could get some settlement out of Exxon. So there was an awful lot of that. I know my days were full. There were days I probably was interviewed 15, 16 times by various press. I don't think there were many days during the first month that I wasn't interviewed at least 6 or 8 times. Good Morning America liked me because I was righteously indignant about just damn near everything at that time. And so to do Good Morning America was like at 3 a.m. And today it would be a lot easier, but back then we had to go up to up on the hill behind the animal shelter where they had all of the equipment for the satellites. And you'd sit up there in this little tight cramped room with electronic equipment, and you'd always have something plugged in your ear, and you'd be watching this tiny little monitor, and you'd be hearing scratchy voices, and you're trying to guess what they're asking you. And you know, because they always call you before you do this to find out, are you going to be righteously indignant enough for them? And so you're always encouraged to be a little more indignant than you might not have even felt like. The last time Good Morning America called me to see if I would be on, it was the Joe Hazelwood trials. And they really wanted, I knew what they wanted, I just couldn't give it to them, because I don't think Hazelwood's drinking was the ultimate cause of the accident. Right. I think it was the system. Yeah. I think it was a system of asking a captain to be on the bridge for 36 to 40 hours. And every one of them went down and went to bed. As soon as they got rid of the pilot, they went to bed, turned it over to their first mate. And of course, in this case, his first mate was down in Seattle doing something, and he had Cousins, who was second or third mate. And that's what caused the accident. I mean, I'm pretty sure Hazelwood drunk could have gone through a 10-mile wide space. I remember Yost saying his kid was 10 years old at the time, and his 10-year-old kid could have driven a tanker through there. And I believe, I mean, it's pretty wide once you get through the Narrows. So, but a lot of those days were just taken up doing things like the first day we could see, oh my God, we're going to have airplane collision, because we had so many takeoffs and landings and people coming in here, industry reporters, everybody all wanting planes. And so I got a hold of the FAA and said, hey, we've got to reopen the Valdez Tower. We have a nice tower out there. And they did immediately. The next real emergency we had, and I think any city that's going to have something like this would run into it. In fact, they did in Louisiana for the hurricanes, and it's communications. You know, for a little town of less than 4,000, well, all of a sudden, you couldn't get a line out of here or in because it was so jammed up. That's when I met Tom Jensen. And I've known Tom, and Tom's even been on my board since. But Tom came into town from the telephone company. Forget which one it was at that time. But anyway, Tom came in and put all these extra lines in so that people could communicate, because it was very frustrating. You just couldn't do it. Trying to fly in and out of Valdez was a nightmare, because the planes were all taken up from oil workers and industry people. We formed what was called at that time the Oiled Mayors. And the Oiled Mayors are made up of mayors and village leaders. And every Thursday we would meet in Anchorage, and we would have a meeting and discuss the spill. And then Friday we would have a press conference, because Friday's a great day for a press conference. And I was usually the spokesperson for the Oiled Mayors, and I would meet with the press, and we would, again, beat Exxon up as much as we could. Because we found that Exxon tended to respond to legislation, litigation, and press. Now, I don't know that that is as prevalent today, because obviously litigation hasn't gotten very far with Exxon, because they're still holding out on the punitive damages. But and the press, they don't seem to be as concerned about public relations. But in 1989, after the spill, the world was mad at Exxon. And they really wanted to do what they could to get rid of that horrible image they have. I remember I had to hire somebody as mayor to help answer. I was getting thousands of letters from all over the world. And we wanted to respond, but there's no way that I could write responses. So we had a person or two that would respond and thank them for their input. And some of them were just cute as could be. I remember there was a lady from Ohio that wrote, just trying to be as helpful as she could, telling me that at the Ohio State Fair, when they have oil spills, they throw sawdust on them. And maybe we should get sawdust, and we could clean this mess up with sawdust. And you know, and then there were others, artists that wanted to do, there was one that wanted to do a huge sculpture of an oil bird and present it to Valdez, and I respectfully declined that. The timing wasn't exactly right for a huge oiled bird sculpture in the middle of Valdez. But the communication, I mean, people were just, the world was incensed by this, because Prince William Sound was viewed as a pristine beauty that had been violated. There was something else. There was another story along that line, and it's kind of slipped my mind now. But we had a lot of communication.
As I was driving from Palmer this morning, I was thinking about how choked those roads must have been at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, they're in ever so much better shape 18 years.
Oh, not the roads have improved considerably. There's still some room for improvement. But yeah, they are much better today than they were back then. And I got to the point where for those Thursday meetings, I always drove. It you just couldn't count on being able to get, you'd get bumped from the plane, and I couldn't afford to get stuck in Anchorage because there were things happening here that required my attention. So
you drove.
I just drove up Thursday, drove back Friday.
Oh, that's so far.
I did that almost every week. We had another guy from out one of the villages out of Kodiak. His name was Charles Christensen. And I was so proud of Charles. I mean, Charles really took it all very seriously, and he came to all of our meetings. Now, it wasn't a problem for me. I mean, Valdez was fairly wealthy. We had a road. You know, it was a little taxing, but I noticed that I didn't sleep much in those days. That was 18 years younger, and I was able to do it. I was getting along on 3 hours of sleep many nights. But Charles was much older than me, and he made all of those meetings. I was really proud of him because he once said to us, he was thanking the oiled mayors for the support they gave him, because he said, without your support, and he was a native fellow. He says, without your support, he said, I wouldn't know how to have done this. But he was always there. Then he was on the board, and when I came back and applied for a job, they said, well, Charles had been on the board for several years and hadn't said a thing. And when I got interviewed, and they said, after I left the room, Charles says, we'll hire him. And the only thing that Charles really had said. But he liked me from the days when we were fighting the big battle together. Well, I haven't mentioned the syndicate mix. That was kind of an interesting time.
Okay, tell me that.
Well, it was early on. It was well within the first month of the spill. In fact, it would have been in May. I was in Anchorage, probably doing one of these Thursday meetings, and the city clerk called, and she said, John, I think you turned that over once.
Oh, you're right. Oh, thank you for telling me that. That's why I have this one standing by. Okay.
The city clerk called me.
The city clerk called you. Okay.
City clerk called me.
Yes.
And she said, John, we've got a couple of Frenchmen here, and they don't speak very much English. But I think they want to help, and there's nobody for them to meet with. And she said, could we send them back to Anchorage, and could you put something together? Yeah, I'll do that. So I got a hold of whatever the French representative is in Anchorage. It wouldn't be a consulate because it's not that big. I don't know. But anyway, she was part-time, former French national, and she lived, and she was a real estate lady, but I found out who it was, and we called her and said, you know, we're going to need an interpreter. And at the time, Josephine's was still in operation at the Sheraton, and I always stayed at the Sheraton. So I set up dinner at Josephine's, and that is when I met Senator Alphonse Arzel and Jean-Baptiste Henri. Senator Arzel was a French senator, and Jean-Baptiste was his assistant, and head of what was called at that time the Syndicate Mix. Syndicate Mix was a French group similar to the group I now head, but they came out of the Amoco Cadiz spill, and they spent years fighting with Amoco, trying to get money from them for the injuries that the Brittany Coast suffered. So they were here. They wanted to help us. And so through all of that, we set it up. And a couple of weeks later, I think there was like 26 representatives from the syndicate mix. There was a lot of Frenchmen. Came to Valdez, and I'd set it up to where We chartered one of Stan Stevens' boats, and we were going to, the first day, we were going to go out, and we were going to visit some of the oiled beaches, and then the second day, we were going to have a conference where we had, and also, I had all of the oiled mayors invited to this, so we had 26 Frenchmen and almost that many oiled mayors. We did the conference up at the Civic Center, and everybody gave their speeches, and by far the very best speeches were some of the native leaders who really spoke from their heart, whereas those of us who were more sophisticated, we sat down and wrote our speeches, and they were dull and not very exciting. But the native leaders talked about what was happening to their society, their fear of the, using subsistence foods, what was going on with their youth. The youth were earning too much money, and they didn't think they could keep them in the village after this was over. One of them coined the term the death of water, and he said he never thought he'd see water die, but the water is dead. And it was very, very moving. But when we took Stan's boat out, we pulled into one of the bays out there, and we had somebody got on the radio and said, "You can't come in here." And Stan radioed back and said, "By whose authority?" And the guy didn't know by whose authority. So he says, "Well, you just can't." Stan says, "Well, be ready because we're coming." And we went in, and it was funny. It was kind of like the photo op for the planes that were flying over the spill. They had this big photo op for us. They had a boat pulling a skimmer around in circles, but there was no oil there. It was so that we could take pictures of it, and they didn't know exactly who we were. But and then we did. We got off the boat and we went on the beach and we saw the oil. But that was quite a day. That was the day I realized that if you're going to have 26 Frenchmen with you, you better have some wine too. Before we got back at the end of the day, I had called and told my staff, I said, "Get some wine and meet us down at the boat dock because these guys are going to rebel." But then the next day we had that, and the French gave us their advice. And we have stayed friends with them ever since. We still meet with them. About a year ago, Patience Faulkner, who is currently the president of RCAC, and Linda Robinson, who is my outreach coordinator, went to France. It was their 30th anniversary or something, and they went over and gave speeches. But it's no longer called the Syndicate Mix. It's called something else, but it's still a group of primarily French politicians that meet and try to keep an eye on the oil industry. But that was kind of nice. So we've had they've been back several times and met with us, and we've been over there and met with them. And it's kind of since then, you know, we have tried to develop communication systems, and of course, our electronics communication has improved immensely. You know, 18 years ago, we were relying on fax machines if you happened to have one.
Right.
But today, you know, we have websites and we share information, and we have national conferences where a lot of us get together, and we hope that no community will be in the same sad shape that Valdez was, or Cordova, or Whittier, or any of the rest. There was no place to turn.
Right.
Nobody you could talk to and say, "Hey, you know, what do we need to worry about? What do we need to do? How do you respond to this?" Coming out of the spill, or it was during the spill, a researcher, a sociologist from, I think Puku is from Alabama, one of the universities down there, he came up and he worked with us, and we developed a program in terms of counseling, because we found that